investigation of those, most of those are the ones that are being investigated by the Inspector General's office involving an agency and gifts, a gifts question, and we're, as soon as we get those, the report of investigation from them, we'll move quickly depending on what the report of investigation says.
Okay.
Publication and reporting obligations. In your Dropbox is a proposed schedule for 2017 meetings, which we must publish in the DC Register. If there are no changes, we will send it forward for publication. Otherwise, we are in compliance with our publication and reporting obligations.
Maybe this is a good moment just to at least check with the board members. We've had these meetings Thursdays at 11 now for, I guess, 2 years, right? And it seems to be working well the first Thursday of the month, recognizing that with five folks who are only special government employees and have other things going on, professional and personal, we occasionally will move them or someone has to participate by phone. But and I know that Ms. Schwartz has already weighed in on two meetings earlier in the year that we're going to shift around a little bit. But are you generally okay with the first Thursday of the month at 11 being the standard time, again, recognizing that, you know, there might be some shifting here and there? Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That sounds good. So we'll go ahead and take a look at the list, but
Where is the list?
It was in the Dropbox.
Mr. Grimaldi, do you have a hard copy?
Okay. So, sure. And if need be, we can adjust any particular date before it gets published. So.
Okay. So if anybody has an issue with any particular date, just let us know before we send it. Otherwise, we'll be sending it for publication in next week's DC Register. Okay. Next item, C, trainings and outreach. Before I get to the trainings, I am pleased to announce that we have been asked by the Center for Ethics and Public Integrity at the National Association of Attorneys General to draft a chapter in their upcoming anti-corruption manual. This manual is essentially an update of the 1988 Department of Justice Public Corruption Manual that included chapters authored by Eric Holder and Rudy Giuliani, back when he was a prosecutor. Our contribution would be the chapter on administrative remedies entitled Non-Criminal Tactics for Fighting Corruption. I think this would be a great exposure, for the office, and would showcase the good work we are doing, and I'm planning on working on a draft over the holiday when things, I hope, quiet down a little bit, although I'm not that optimistic. Things are going to quiet down. Okay, so meetings attended by staff. Ms. Alawamne, our auditor, attended a class on audit evidence and documentation offered by the Graduate School USA and two writing classes tailored for government auditors offered by the Council of Inspectors General on Integrity and Efficiency, or as she likes to say, CIGIE, C-I-G-I-E, Audit Inspection and Evaluation Academy. She is now at a 3-day critical thinking skills class also offered by CIGIE. These are important because it keeps her certified as an auditor.
And it's paying off, as we've seen in some of the reports she's been issuing recently, which I think we've said in a number of our public meetings are really terrific and demonstrate the benefit of having someone, even though she's overwhelmed by the volume of what she has to do, but producing really top quality audit reports.
I really do appreciate that she's sort of taken this on because, you know, when we were created, we had investigators but no auditors,
right.
And so it was really, she's filled an important gap there by giving us that auditing skill set. Conducted by staff, we did 13, including two new employee orientations, two MSS trainings, one general board and commission training, a training session at the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, Medical Care Advisory Committee, two training sessions for third-party inspection vendors at DCRA, a session at DCPS, one training session for the State Board of Education, and one Donations Act training, which we did in conjunction with the Office of Partnership and Grant Services. We also conducted a special 2-hour training for new board member Collier.
Your French background's popping in.
On the same day that she was sworn in by the mayor on November 18th, so we wasted no time. All right, item D, advisory opinions, informal advice. We did 58 since the last meeting. That's up from 42 last month. Since the date of the last meeting, we've issued one formal advisory opinion, which was published in the DC Register last Friday. That was formal advisory opinion number 1583-001, in which we issued post-employment guidance on whether a former DHCD and DMPED employee was subject to any post-employment restrictions given his new position as project director at Wynn Companies, W-I-N-N. This opinion was published unredacted on November 29, 2016, with the permission of the requester. We also recently completed a sua sponte advisory opinion on social media. It was drafted by Mr. Chanoon, which really it was a great effort to sort of outline what's permissible and what's not in the ethics realm with respect to social media. It's in still in draft form because it's a sua sponte opinion. It has to be published in draft form in the DC Register for a 30-day period before I finalize it. So certainly, if anybody has any requests, comments, you know, that they want added or deleted from there, just let me know during that time before we finalize it. Both opinions are in your Dropbox.
Thank you.
All right, item E, ethics legislation and the Comprehensive Code of Conduct.
Yes, very distressing, I have to say.
So you'll recall from last month's meeting that the Committee on the Judiciary had asked us to comment on four bills that were the subjects of public hearings on November 16th. Two of the bills would amend provisions in the Campaign Finance Reform Act, which Vega does not enforce, so we have decided not to comment on them. One of the other bills, Bill 21-509, would abolish the Office of Campaign Finance and establish in its place a new office within Vega called the Citizens Fair Election Oversight Office. For the reasons discussed at the meeting, we sent a letter to Councilmember McDuffie joining the Office of Campaign Finance and the Board of Elections in opposition to the bill. The other bill, Bill 21622, is the one that Attorney General Carl Racine had introduced and discussed at the symposium. Much of the bill is addressed to pay to play, but it would also amend the Local Hatch Act and the ethics training provisions for certain new employees in the Comprehensive Merit Personnel Act. Again, for the reasons discussed at the meeting, we sent a letter to Councilmember McDuffie explaining why related provisions in the CCC were more sound. And speaking of the CCC, I'll turn it over to Mr. Grimaldi and let him be the bearer of bad news.
I'm assuming the role voluntarily. with respect to the CCC, unfortunately, after a conversation I had with one of Councilmember McDuffie's staffers, it will lapse. Bill 21-250 will lapse at the end of this period, which is December 31st. In short, the explanation I was given, and I had enough experience with the staffer, that we weren't getting spun around. We got the straight dirt, so to speak. There were some practical considerations on their end. They lost some staff. They had other things in the hopper, which they had identified as other legislative priorities, and those considerations combined to not have the committee mark up the bill as we had been told it would do on November 16th. So under the council rules, because there will be no official action by the council on the bill by the end of this period, which again ends the end of this month, the bill will lapse. However, under that same council rule, that lapsing is without prejudice, and the staffer told me that Councilmember McDuffie intends to reintroduce the bill the first legislative meeting next period. Now, that opens up, and Mr. Flowers can explain perhaps a little bit more, you know, some interesting possibilities. Because we introduced the bill initially, it went through Chairman Mendelson. That's just the way it's set up, because we're an independent agency. However, the sense we got collectively over the months, the committee had done a lot of work on the bill, and the staffer went so far as to tell me that they had even incorporated some of the provisions of Councilmember Nadeau's bill that had been introduced very early on this period, which incorporated some of the recommendations we made, I think, in the 2014 BPR.
Right, that's exactly right.
So, Brian, the council member, the council member could introduce a substantially similar bill, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He can introduce any legislation he wants to introduce, but that wouldn't preclude us from also introducing our own version if we chose to do so.
Yeah, so
but practically, if he introduces another version, he's going to be there to receive our bill.
So I have to say that I'm feeling a little torn here, because on the one hand, I certainly appreciate the fact that the council's got a lot on its plate and there's a lot going on, and when your staff is reduced, there's issues. But this bill's been pending for 2 years. 2 years. And this is not something that we dreamed up. They asked us, heck, they ordered us in legislation to do exactly this. We spent a lot of time and a lot of consideration getting the bill together in a form that would be easy for them to work with and mark up should they so choose. You gentlemen, Mr. Grimaldi, did a dog and pony show for the committee members to explain to them kind of what the substantial significant pieces of the bill were, answer any questions they had, try to address their concerns. We then, because it had been pending for so long, gave them updates on things that we had learned in the interim and little glitches that we had found along the way. And so it's more than a little distressing that we are now 2 years in and this bill is going to lapse. And again, I have every reason to believe that it will get reintroduced, whether it's by the chairman or by Councilmember McDuffie or by us. I mean, somehow or other it will get reintroduced. I don't have any doubt about that. But it does seem to me that the major ethics push that the district had when we were first created and bills flying right and left seems to have cooled off significantly, probably because, with all due respect to the success of moving from an enforcement mentality to a training and advisory mentality, when it's now no longer the front page of the newspaper, ethical lapses, but rather it is, as you've heard in this meeting here today, 20 trainings that were done in a month's period of time between the two offices. And so it is a little, it would be best for the employees, the public officials of the District of Columbia, to have a unified, comprehensive code of conduct they can look to and understand what their rules and responsibilities are, applies equally across the legislative and executive branches, fixes all the inconsistencies, all the things that we did sooner rather than later, when we are not in the middle of an ethical crisis and we're not in the middle of, and we're not changing the rules, if you will, or modifying the rules in the middle of some kind of hotbed of whatever is going on. Now, hopefully that will never occur, that we've kind of, the government's on a great path, things seem to be going well. But this is exactly when you do these things, right? You get it in the periods of relative calm so that it prevents stuff from spinning out of control. So I will, I will express my personal disappointment that we are now at the 2-year mark and it's not moved forward, and express my great hope and optimism that it will be reintroduced sooner rather than later at the beginning of the new council period so we can finally get this thing put to bed.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, go ahead.
Yes, ma'am.
I would like, though, to see us put our bill with the amendments. I know you put a bill in before I got here at the request of the council for you all to do that. And then I know you made amendments to it as you moved along and found different things that you might have done differently and put those changes in. I would like the bill as introduced with the changes that you made during that 2-year period to be put forward by us. I mean, the fact that they took some of it and put it in somebody else's bill doesn't necessarily mean that everything we wanted. I also think that with all the work that this board did and its staff did, that our bill should be comprehensive in there. in its full comprehensive manner, even if a part was taken out here and there. I just think we should officially send over as soon as the session begins, like immediately, the first day, our full bill as amended from the beginning, so that we are on record of having our full bill and our desire to get it done. And I think if it gets introduced, we're not sure it's going to be introduced as we want it introduced. And so I would suggest we do that. We are created by the council board. And then to find out that they officially ask you to do something like this, I think that it should stay together as our recommendations, our full recommendations, and that, Mr. Chairman, we should send them over under your name and the board's name as soon as you possibly can.
Well, as a practical matter, our next meeting is January 5th, right? So that's...
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Being the pen of this operation. I'll be spending the balance of this month finishing up the best practices report, which is due on the 31st. And on a related note, based on my initial draft, rather, there's some ink spilled about the comprehensive code of conduct. So I need to finish that because that's on a schedule. What I'm going to suggest, and I think this is doable, I can have a redlined version of the bill for your consideration at the January meeting, January 5. And if you vote that's what we want to introduce, then right. You can. So.
And the new council doesn't get sworn in until when?
January 2nd.
No, it is the 2nd.
It is.
Okay. So all of the presidency.
So we'll know. So I think that makes sense. That because we will have to, if it's going to be our bill, obviously we're going to have to make it ours. But I do think that makes sense. Then we'll see where we are on January 5th. And if for some reason, we'll have ours ready to go. And if it's not already in there, we can vote on it and move forward.
Okay. Right. I mean, I can't imagine.
That's the problem is that I have no doubt that the intention is there, right? By whether it's Chairman McDuffie of the committee or Chairman Mendelson of the council as a whole to do this. Like I don't doubt that they're interested in getting it done. But what tends to happen, as you know, is that the thing of the moment takes over and then this winds up becoming backseat material. And we'll have a new council with some new council members who are going to want to do all kinds of stuff right out of the box. And so I think that it's at least worth considering what Ms. Schwartz has suggested, which is being ready to go. Now, it's good, it'll take a vote of ours on the amended bill to do that, but if Mr. Grimaldi can at least get us in that position by the 5th, then we can see where we are and move forward.
All right. Sounds good to me.
Does that work? Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much. Sorry.
There is a bit of good news. Because you're going to finish up with Mendelson's bill. Bill 521-509 that was going to send OCF over here will also lapse.
Yes, we are relieved. We are greatly relieved on that one.
On that positive note, I'm going to end my spiel.
On the last thing I want to mention on the legislation is Chairman Mendelson's bill to increase the financial disclosure filings by council members to twice a year instead of current once a year, and to add members of the WMATA board to the list of required financial disclosure filings.
Which is a good move.
The bill is moving. We were consulted concerning the fiscal impact the legislation would have on the office. We pointed out that in addition to the added administrative, auditing, and legal burden that would have to be undertaken by our staff, that we would also have to alter our already failing and antiquated e-filing system to accommodate the additional filing obligations. After some back and forth discussions, the Office of the Chief Financial Officer issued a fiscal impact statement that essentially finds that it would require half of an FTE our full-time employee, and $50,000 for the e-filing system alterations. I think that's very optimistic, but that's what it is. And so we'll see what impact that has on whether or not the legislation gets enacted. Item F, rulemaking. We don't have any rulemaking updates at the moment. On the budget, I'm pleased to report that the chairman and I had a very productive meeting with the mayor's budget chief. We obtained a commitment to provide us with $36,000 in immediate supplemental funds necessary to migrate the website away from the private vendor used by the Office of Open Government and back to Okto, where it resided originally. We have a meeting next Wednesday with Okto to get the process moving, and I'm told it shouldn't take long after that to complete the project. I hope we have the same success with our capital budget request with respect to our now 12-year outdated e-filing system, which is estimated by Okto will cost close to $1 million over a 5-year period to replace and maintain.
Yeah, and I will. I want to publicly thank Matt Brown for his quick willingness, once we fully explained what the situation was, to help identify funds to make that happen, and also Betsy Cavendish, who provided the mayor's support in that meeting as well. It took forever to get to the meeting, but once we got to the meeting, it kind of actually went fairly smoothly, so I want to thank the mayor and the chief financial officer's office for making that happen. It's very important.
Likewise. On staffing, I'm proud to report that Attorney Cooks, who began FMLA on November 14th, is a proud mother, and mom and child are doing fine.
Do we have a name?
Noah.
Noah, beautiful.
We have identified a temporary attorney to assist us until she returns in March. We hope to have a temporary attorney on board by this coming Monday, but we'll see. We're still trying to get the paperwork done. We will also be losing Ms. Dillian to FMLA next week. Ms. Dillian, of course, is our valued staffer who handles lobbyists and FDS. And I'd like to thank the Vega staff in advance for stepping up to help out in her absence, so far as we have no plans to bring in a replacement for her. On the upside, I believe that she only plans to take 8 weeks of leave. Thank goodness. Item I, lobbyist and financial disclosure matters. We'll be sending reminder letters to out to lobbyists regarding the January 2017 lobbyist activity report filing date, January 16th, 2017. We'll be sending reminder letters out to lobbyists. And as you are aware, we updated the board last month on the outcome of the July 2016 lobbyist activity reports, or LARs. These are desk reviews conducted by Auditor Al-Awamne on the LARs that are filed with us. We've sent inquiry letters to those five entities to ascertain their business relationships with the lobbyists, that disclose them as their clients, including how long the affected lobbyists have been working for each of them, and what activities these entities are authorized to undertake on their behalf. We anticipate responses.
I think three of them have already responded. I'm not sure about the other two.
Excuse me, I think that's dated information there. We do have several draft audits to discuss with the board, though, during the confidential portion of the meeting today. On the financial disclosure side, we're only going to discuss, I think, today the conflict of interest waivers. Item J. Yeah, there's nothing to report on the financial disclosure statements. Uh-huh. Things are calm at the moment. But on the conflict of interest waivers, we have still one public one that's outstanding.
This and that's the Fire EMS?
Yeah, the FEMS. Just to bring everyone back up to speed, on November 7th, the DC Fire and Emergency Medical Services Department, or FEM, filed a response to the board's August 22nd order, finding the record insufficient to determine whether any first responder has a conflict of interest, and that FEMS has failed to provide a sufficient basis for granting a waiver. FEMS makes essentially two arguments. First, that the number of FEMS employees, 4 out of 6, who would be in a position to influence AMR's response times is not significant enough to, quote, have more than a de minimis effect on penalty risk outcome for AMR, end quote. Second, that AMR's response times are already beyond the contract thresholds for triggering penalties, so the FEMS employees' potential impact is moot. Our opposition to FEMS EMTs simultaneously working for FEMS and AMR was based on the premise that FEMS EMTs' direct participation in recommending or not recommending AMR for the transport of basic life support patients was likely to have a direct and predictable effect on the financial interests of AMR and would result in a conflict of interest, or at least the appearance of one. The FEMS submission does not address the appearance issue described more fully at page 4 of our April 14, 2016 memorandum to the board, or the longer-term implication if the demand for AMR services change. We are asking the board again to deny the waiver request.
All right, so there has been, we obviously got to see the response, your response to their submission, which was fairly detailed in terms of a statistical analysis of the likelihood that any one of these folks could have a real impact on either the calls or the financial outcome of the contract because it's a fixed fee and has nothing to do with hourly rates and the rest. Mr. Grimaldi, do you have anything to add to the presentation before we take this up?
Just one thing. Since the board entered its order in August, what had been a letter contract has now become an official long-term contract. So that's just a fact. And just to remind some of you and to tell you for the first time that even before I believe the letter contract was let, the council had passed legislation that extends the public duty doctrine to any services provided by AMR here. The district, in other words, would be protected now by law under the public duty doctrine. So those are, you know, just two FYI pieces of info. That's redundant. FYI.
So when the representatives from Fire EMS came to us back in the spring, they explained to us, obviously, the need for the additional services, the basis, you know, why they're doing what they're doing, and also many benefits that flow from having D.C. government, experienced D.C. government employees on their trucks, or, you know, who've been hired by AMR on a part-time basis. They explained to us that they know about them because they're required to get approval to work there and because they have to report essentially that they're working for AMR and that they have a process in place by which somebody couldn't sort of surreptitiously be working for AMR without knowing about it. But a lot of words have been spilled over this trying to describe what these folks do and don't do, and it seems to me, and based on a lot of the correspondence back and forth, although I hear what your argument is, Mr. Sobin, about the appearance issue, the actual likelihood that any of these employees could have any material impact on AMR or would gain from anything that is done by calling or not calling an AMR is practically not going to happen because of where they sit in the food chain. One person, as I understand it, one of the folks plays no role in any of this, right? He was like a warehouse worker or something.
Right.
So he's not even on an ambulance or not in a position to call or not call when someone comes. And the rest, the likelihood that they would actually impact the particular call or the outcome at the end of the day is so low. And I think de minimis is probably a generous description of what the impact could be, that I personally don't find it to be, I think it's to the extent that there is a conflict and query whether they're, you know, given under the circumstances how that fits, and I know that there's some discussion about that as well. I would grant the waiver request to these folks with the understanding that these only applies to the folks that they've identified, and if in the future, because if you're further up in the food chain, you wind up being the lead person on the ambulance making the call, That might change our analysis in any particular case. But I personally would, with all due respect to your position, vote to grant the waiver request as they've seen. I would also say that because the district has extended the public duty doctrine, and I personally see way more AMR ambulances out there than I do our own, I think the public at large sees them as providing the district's EMS services, if you will. And so therefore, I don't think that as an appearance, if you were to see a DC government employee on an AMR ambulance, I don't think anybody's going to be batting an eye at it as if somehow or other that was something inappropriate or improper. So therefore, I will personally vote to grant the waivers, again, with all due respect to your position.
I would like to abstain. I would like to abstain from the vote on this and like to be recorded as abstaining.
Ms. Hutchison?
I vote to grant the waiver.
Okay. Mr. Wade, I apologize. I'm just going to go in order.
That's okay.
I vote to grant the waiver.
Ms. Collier?
I vote to grant the waiver with the understanding that it's not a blanket waiver. It's only for the individuals identified.
Right, and so the paper trail that we've created in this case makes it very clear. In fact, because the first time it came to us, we sent it back saying, essentially, describe for us or give us more information, and they sat on it for a number of months before giving us more information. And now that we have a permanent contract, and now that we have greater detail about not only what they do but what the impact is going to be, I completely agree that this is a per-person waiver and not a blanket waiver.
Right, and I don't have any present recollection of there are now four of the six. Mr. Sobin is not opposed. Now another person, and there's just no conflict with
right.
respect to, I think he drives the truck or something like that. So there'll be four
waivers.
Express waivers.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Item K.
On to item K. Non-confidential investigations. And so this is the matter of Inmate Adrian Williams. This is a formal investigation involving allegations that the respondent, now a former workforce development specialist at the Department of Employment Services, or DOES, used his official government position for personal gain. The complaint alleges that on March 11th, 2016, Mr. Williams propositioned an applicant for DOES assistance with a sexual proposition in a telephone conversation that she recorded and documented with text messages. The respondent gave the applicant his business card, government and personal cell numbers, and offered the applicant money and greater employment opportunities in exchange for sex. He subsequently lied about his involvement with the applicant until he was confronted with a conversation recorded by the complaining witness. The board previously asked that we re-interview Mr. Williams to ensure that this was an isolated incident and not part of a pattern of behavior. We did, in fact, interview Mr. Williams last Friday when he appeared pursuant to a subpoena authorized by the board. Based on that interview and respondent having completed the terms of his deferred sentencing, we are recommending that the board dismiss this matter without prejudice for the following reasons. One, the respondent is currently unemployed. Two, respondent did not commit any other offense during his tenure with the district. Three, the Office of Government Ethics would be required to expend resources that are better used for other investigations. Four, the director may reopen this investigation and pursue action against respondent within the applicable limitations period if he determines that there is reason to do so. But mostly because we think that the criminal justice system did its job here, and it's anything we could do at this point really wouldn't make much of a difference.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you say the criminal justice system did its, what did they do? I mean, the fact he's unemployed, did he get fired? I mean, I don't think we have an explanation of the criminal justice system having done it. And what we just read.
Sure.
So I'd like to have a little more detail.
He entered into a deferred sentencing agreement.
Which is a guilty plea.
He entered a guilty plea, entered into a deferred sentencing agreement, which required that he commit complete 48 hours of community service. He completed that time. There is a hearing scheduled for December 9th, in which he's going to appear before the court with respect to this.
Okay. So I did read this in the Dropbox, but I do think since we were having a public discussion that it would be good to make it a part of the record.
Right. And just for the record, a deferred sentencing agreement is what the U.S. Attorney's Office and sometimes the Attorney General's Office uses to as a way to resolve a pending criminal case, someone who's been charged with a crime, as he was. And in this case, Mr. Williams entered a guilty plea to a criminal offense, and they defer the sentencing so he can complete a number of conditions. And if he completes the conditions successfully, which includes, typically speaking, community service, some kind of counseling, sometimes restitution, if there's a crime to be, you know, made whole on the financial side, and maybe other things as well, if they do that and stay out of trouble for a period of typically 6 to 9 months, then the case will be dismissed on the sentencing date. I think this is a status date, a check-in date, the one that's coming up this week. But on the sentencing date, it would be dismissed, and therefore he would avoid he would always have the arrest and charge, but he would avoid the conviction on his record if he satisfied all those conditions. It's typically for first-time offenders. So, but apparently he also is he's lost his job with the district. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes. So.
Okay. I just wanted that part of the record.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. I think it's important. And so for the reasons that you've just outlined, I would vote to dismiss the case.
I would vote to dismiss as well.
I also vote to dismiss.
Vote to dismiss?
Dismiss.
All right.
We have an order.
Is this a chairman only or an everybody order?
It's a chairman only.
Okay.
We're trying to move to the chairman only, especially now that we have five. So we're not sending documents around to everybody.
The vote's on the record, so we're 12, 8, 6, 10. Thank you, Mr. Chenu.
Thank you.
All right.
That's all we have for the non-confidential investigations portion of the meeting. We
all
have
right.
Several to discuss.
In the confidential portion? All right. So this, before we move to the confidential closed portion of the meeting, we typically make time available for members of the public to come up and comment to the board on matters that are appropriately before the board. So at this point, if anybody would like to do so, now would be the time. All right, and seeing none.
Can I just add one thing?
Yes, ma'am.
Given our technical challenges today, we can anticipate having to publish written meeting minutes. So what we have customarily done when this has occurred in the past, right, but the recordings have been disjointed.
We can do them both. And so if Mr. Sobin has his going and I have this one going on up here and passing it around, perhaps we can...
We can certainly try to do that, but given the fact that they're digital audio recorders, we don't always know if we've picked up everything.
Right.
So just be prepared. I mean, we're going to listen to them, but there's a very real possibility we may have to do just written meeting minutes, but typically what we've done, since Mr. Sobin and I are reading from what we've written anyway, we just use that as the meeting minutes.
Right.
And we'll have to fold in the comments from the board and then the roll call votes themselves.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right, so the time is...
I'm sorry. Are we going to figure out, though, what's wrong with the room and why it's not operating on a consistently...
The room, it operates on a consistent basis. Again, we have no control. The room was operating as recently as yesterday without a problem. But apparently there appears to be something happening with the Octo server, which we have no control over whatsoever.
Right.
When the recording button is pushed, it goes to a secured Octo server that we don't have any ability to ensure is operating at any given time or not, other than just testing the equipment. So although I recognize the inconvenience that this has caused, it doesn't happen very often, but we've tried to get in touch with Octo to find out what's going on. But in the interim, we've got the backup recordings, and we've also got the full script. So.
Right. Thank you, and I appreciate the efforts to try to get the backup and running. Okay, so the time is 11:48, and I would entertain at this time a motion to move to an executive non-public session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B, to deliberate on a decision in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to DC Code 2-575B10. If I could have such a motion, please.
I move that we go into executive session.
So moved. And seconded. And seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? No. Okay, so because I had, that's still 11:48. I must have spoken quickly. All right, so we'll go off the public record at this point. Time is 12:34. We're back on the public record. We've been in closed session. I have a few matters to report out to the public as a result of the closed matters. First, in the matter of In re Warren Graves, this is case 1535-001. Mr. Graves was referred to us as a formal investigation after we discovered that Mr. Graves had entered a guilty plea in United States District Court to essentially tax fraud covering a number of years. The U.S. Attorney's Office initiated a prosecution. He entered a guilty plea and is paying back more than $200,000 in restitution. As a result, the board has moved to dismiss the investigation, finding that there was no reason for a separate enforcement action by a civil enforcement action by us to sanction him, given the criminal prosecution and the fact that he'll be paying $200 a month for 92 years. The second matter is In re Michael Mitchell. It's matter 1080-002, referred to us from the Inspector General. Mr. Mitchell was a Department of Health employee who misused his government vehicle by driving to his bank in Crystal City, Virginia, on a number of occasions. He was suspended from his job, and he also, as a result, was suspended without pay for a period of time. It's a personnel side that we don't have any control over. On our side, he entered into a negotiated disposition, agreed to pay a $300 fine for misuse of government property. That negotiated disposition will be posted on the website. In the matter of In re Silroy Brown, matter 1548-001, Mr. Brown is a DCRA fire inspection reviewer who was involved in the permitting application connected to an organization that his former domestic partner, now wife, is an owner of. He entered into a negotiated disposition acknowledging the conflict of interest and agreeing to pay a $1,000 fine. That will also be published on the website. In matter In re Ann Wallace, matter 1209-002, Ms. Wallace is the ANC Commissioner for Single Member District 3E-01, and she is the chairperson for Tenleytown Main Street. And in her role as an ANC commissioner, she voted to approve two source grant applications from the ANC to Tenleytown Main Street, amounting to about $3,000, $3,700, not disclosing the conflict of interest and taking action in that role. She entered into a negotiated disposition as a result of that, by which she agreed that the board would censure her in a public admonition. That will also be posted on the website. Next, we received four conflict of interest waiver requests by four members of the board of the Washington Conventions and Sports Authority, which does business as Events DC. They had come to us as they were negotiating a potential lease deal with Apple to lease the Carnegie Mellon Library right in front of the Convention Center for a flagship store. And to their great credit, and we very much appreciate this, they came to us in advance recognizing that four members of the authority have stock, directly owned and controlled stock, in Apple and therefore would pose a potential conflict. They fronted all of the issues, went so far as to at least, and to include allowing us, that is Mr. Grimaldi on behalf of the board and Mr. Sobin on behalf of the Office of Government Ethics, to review the letter of intent and the terms to ensure that it was going to be a commercially reasonable deal under the circumstances. They disclosed all of their information, including the value of their stock. We considered whether or not it would technically be a conflict, and it technically would for these four individuals because their stock holdings exceed the minimum threshold of what the amount would be to cause a conflict. However, given the billions of dollars of stock that exists out there for Apple, and given the very favorable terms of the lease of the building, and the also favorable terms for the city and for the Sports Authority, we find that a waiver is justified under the circumstances, and so the board has voted in all four instances to grant the waiver requests. And once again, I will say this, that we very much appreciate the fact that the members who had the who couldn't say one way or the other whether they had the conflict, fronted the issue through the general counsel. They disclosed everything to us. They were very cooperative throughout the process. They are an example of how it is best to get in front of the issue rather than go ahead and do it and then ask for forgiveness afterwards. So we thank them very much and commend in particular their general counsel for bringing the issue to us in advance. And finally, one of our staff members here at the board, she is an auditor, a certified auditor, and she does periodic desk reviews and audits of lobbyist registration and activity reports, and there are three audits that will be posted, have been approved on the website, where each of the organizations had minor technical things that needed to be adjusted in their reports, all of which they did willingly, and you will see through the reports the great work that the auditor does, and we are reminded how efficiently the process works, notwithstanding our decades-old filing system, but the process seems to be working well. So you'll see that reflected in the reports. And that concludes the matters report out from the public session. Any members have anything else they want to discuss before we close out for the day?
Yeah.
Mr. Sindrum, I see you here. I'm going to allow you to speak for literally just 3 minutes because our public opportunity has passed. So I'm going to give you 3 minutes, okay? Just so we're clear about this. 12:41. Come, Ms. Foster, if you don't mind. Just for the record, we meet Thursdays at 11 a.m., and we do the public session before we go to the closed session.
You might want to move Tracy's.
Yeah, thank you.
Name.
Appreciate the board's indulgence. However, the agenda does say discussion of any remaining public items, and this is one of them. Remember, Mr. Chairman, disabled veterans served our country more than most. Per me dislocated kneecap, it's a struggle to come down here.
For the record, could you just identify yourself, please?
Michael Sindrum, disabled veteran, served our country more than most. I thought you did, Judge Spagnoletti.
I was just getting you to identify yourself, since who knows what I'm saying.
All right, I passed up, for the record, to continue my testimony last session. And I have to say, I was really blindsided by Mr. Sobin, who talked about that pre-filing injunction against me. So I passed up a Fourth Circuit order, which, and it's captured the Michael J. Sindrum versus the Honorable Gerald Bruce Lee et al., of which you indicate you know. In relevant part, it states, and I quote, "Before enjoining the filing of further actions, however, district court, or be it BIGA, must afford the litigant notice and an opportunity to be heard with the respective case law. Here, the district court, or if you will, BIGA, sua sponte, on its own, issued the injunction. Because BIGA imposed the injunction without affording me, Sindrum, an opportunity to be heard, we grant Sindrum's request to proceed in formal pauperis on appeal, vacate the district court's order, and remand for further proceedings." As you're aware, Judge Spagnoletti, the Fourth Circuit is one of the most, if not the most, conservative, right? And they have no cut card, particularly when it comes to me. But the point being is, notice and an opportunity to be heard. When Mr. Sobin gave his representation last go around, he indicated nothing of a sort, meaning that should wash it away. I understand he has some concerns that when I file, it triggers something, but I'm not stupid, you know, pushing 60. And what actually led to that, I passed up a settlement agreement from the Office of Human Rights, right, from 2008, which has yet to be enforced. Problem is that the investigator at the time had some ties with the Office of Human Rights. So indeed, if this office has conflict of interest, where do I turn? And instead of doing the right thing in the pursuit of right reason and fairness, hammers me, Sassoon gets on the board, and voila, not good. Bottom line is that this settlement agreement needs to be looked at, follow-up investigation, if you will. And I reached out or attempted to with Mr. Cook. He has yet to return my call, so I would appreciate it if you would. As long as he doesn't bite me, I won't bite him. So we can take care of some of these matters that are time-sensitive, right? There are issues that involve...
Mr. Sindrum, your time is up. I know that goes as three... It's a very quick 3 minutes.
Well, we had some... to wrap up, we have a time-sensitive issue with an outgoing councilwoman, LaRue May, and I'd like, before she departs soon, you know, for some follow-up action, notwithstanding other things that remain pending and acted upon. So I'm deferring to you. This is the law of the case, if you will, and we can't make up the rules we go along, which is what's been done.
Thank you, Mr. Sindrum. Yes, sir.
I am Jonathan O'Connell from the Washington Post. I just have a couple quick questions about the NCC matter.
Sure. Do you want to come on up?
Oh, wherever.
Can I just say, we're still on the public record, if you want to do, because we're happy to talk to you.
You can take a seat and speak to
him. Oh, I don't need to be on the record. I just need to answer the question. It doesn't matter if it's on the record or not to me. I mean,
have a seat.
All right.
It matters to us.
Yeah, that's right. I'll sit here then. Can you say which members it were that that brought the Apple stock matter to you?
Yes.
Come on. Yeah. And I'm also interested in how much stock they might
I don't think I can answer that from here. So it was Max Brown, William Hall, Alan, I'm not sure if you pronounce it, Bubes or Bubes, B-U-B-E-S, and Mimsy Lindner.
Did they say how much stock they have?
I know that the amount of stock ranged between the high end was $170,000. I don't remember what the low end was.
60.
Okay.
I'm just sitting here now. I couldn't tell you which one was which.
That's right. Do you remember who had the 170?
I don't. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Did you get to find out when they bought it by chance?
No. It was pre-existing prior to... They had it out at the time they asked for our waiver. That's all I can tell
you. We don't know if it was like a day or 10 years before or somewhere in between. Yeah,
we're not... We're not the SEC. We're not looking into insider trading.
Yeah, me either. Did you all...
Not that I don't know where your brain is going.
No, I don't. I don't know. It just occurred to me.
That's my other job.
I apologize because I haven't covered this board before, but
yes.
Did you all take a vote on that then? Like whether they should be granted the exception?
The request for waiver comes to us confidentially. We discuss it in a confidential session.
Uh-huh.
And then once we vote on it and it becomes a public matter, then we report it out.
Okay, so
that's what happened today.
Can you say what the vote was?
Unanimous.
It was unanimous.
So it was unanimous, okay. And then I have one other question. Mr. Brown, has he ever had an issue? An issue surrounding Mr. Brown been before this body before?
The answer is yes.
Do you remember what that one was?
There is a published, it's on the published negotiated disposition on the website.
Okay. You can help me find that.
Yeah.
All right. Appreciate that. And is there any other, there's nothing else beyond this for you? Okay.
Can I add something?
Sure, yeah.
I just wanted to add that we did, when we discussed this earlier, want to make sure that the district through its the authority and Vets DC be getting a fair deal for the city since Carnegie Library is owned by the city.
Yeah.
And our staff did research on that, and we were brought up to snuff on that today, and they are certainly getting a very fair deal, it appears. The district is getting a very fair deal from Apple, mm-hmm. and that certainly I think gave us all a better feeling of confidence about not at least Apple getting a better deal because of the stockholders.
Sure. And to the point also, it's a very large company. It's hard to picture one store enriching, you know, a few small number of stockholders. So that's really all my questions.
Thank you very much.
Just a point of order, Mr. Chair. will the you'll take under advisement that pre-filing injunction of well-settled case law.
We will. We've heard everything you had to say, and we will take it under advisement. We will. I will, but I do need to adjourn us now. So we are adjourning now until our next meeting, which will be in 2017 on January 5th.
The time?
11 a.m. Same as today. It is now 12:49, and we're going off to public record.
Let you wear, too, the Office of Veterans Affairs.